Media Production.
Welcome back to another episode of the Cold Shower Podcast. Before I get into the conversation with my new friend, Peyton, I want to remind you that this episode is brought to you by Cold Shower Media. Cold Shower Media is my company. We are coming up on our 1 year anniversary, and we focus on podcast and audio production. I'm really excited with the direction things have been going. My clients are excited, which is the main thing, where I think right now there's about 10 different projects that are live and that I'm working on, and just helping companies and individuals get their podcast started. And this happens at all different levels. Some of them come to me with audio that just needs cleaning up. I can do that for them and then send it back to them, and they can do what they would like with that audio, all the way to full-scale production, which could mean I'm lending my own voice to their project. I am helping with formatting and the style of the show, coming up with episode descriptions and all different types of things. So there are many services available, from basic to much more intensive. And I'm just really excited with how Cold Shower Media has been going in its first year. So if you're at all interested in any of the stuff that I have going on with Cold Shower Media, feel free to reach out to me on social media. My links are in the show notes, or just email me, taylor@coldshowerpodcast.com. Now, this also reminds me, and we had talked about this with my friend and guest on the show, Peyton, at the end, the importance of leaving ratings and reviews for services and things that you enjoy. So if you go to a small restaurant, a mom and pop shop, and you like the food that they served you, leave a rating and review. If you buy a book from a author on Amazon and it looks like they could use some ratings and reviews, leave a rating and review. The same thing goes for this podcast. Now, I don't want to go out on a limb and say that by not leaving a rating and review for the podcast, it would be the same as a museum coming across a Picasso painting and just throwing it in the basement. But it's a little bit like that. If I don't get ratings and reviews, then the world at large is not privy to the type of content that I'm creating and putting out there. And basically, I just want this for my guests. My guests come on and they do a great job talking about their experiences and the things that they know. And they have so much knowledge and wisdom to share with people. I want them to get the clout that they deserve. So if you go on Apple Podcasts and search Cold Shower Podcast and leave a rating and a review, I don't even care what kind you leave. Just leave whichever one you think is fair. I would really love that and appreciate that. And so would my guests. All right. I had an excellent conversation with, like I said, a new friend, Peyton. We were connected online. She recently wrote a book on loneliness. And so we discussed that. We discussed her history of some struggles with mental health, and then also just trying to figure out, where do we fit into other people's stories? How can we be of service to other people as they may be dealing with loneliness as well? And so this was just a really cool conversation. And I'd mentioned to her off air that I like talking to people that are excited about what they have going on. And it's very clear with Peyton that that is exactly the category she falls in. So please give this episode a listen and enjoy. It's on loneliness. Here we go. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Cold Shower Podcast. Peyton, I'm really excited to have you here today. I was plowing through your book as quickly as I could when I ordered it. But could you go ahead and just introduce yourself and give a little overview for the listeners of what you do and who you are?
Sure. Yeah, I'm excited to be here. So I'm Peyton Garland. I'm the author of Not So By Myself. It's a book about my experience when my husband was gone with his first gig as a pilot and what that experience was like for me, kind of manning the fort at home. My husband and I also just moved to Colorado Springs for a piloting job for him. So we're loving the cool weather, all the hikes and adventures. And when we're not hiking or adventuring, we are trying to tame our two terrible gremlin dogs, Alfie and Daisy.
Yeah, you mentioned them quite a bit in your book, and I'm a huge dog fan. So I was always excited to hear when you were telling different stories about them.
They tend to be the favorites in the book. When people mention the book, it's Alfie and Daisy every time.
Yeah, that and the chipmunk story, which I won't ruin it for anybody. We'll plug your book at the end, as they can definitely get their own copy. So when you had reached out to me, we had gotten matched up on this site called Podmatch, which is a free service where you can plug in a couple of keywords and then find, I guess, you know, like-minded individuals to either go on their show or they come on yours. And gotten talking about like some personal growth stuff, some faith-based items as well. And you had said that you wrote this book on loneliness. And that was actually something that I think I had kind of wanted to talk about in the past. I've talked with widows. I've talked with people that have experienced loss in their life. And I kind of thought your book would be similar. Like maybe there was some major loss But it seemed more that there was other things going on. You talked about your mental health. So could you just go through like your history with some of those things in terms of loneliness?
Yeah. So loneliness hit hard even as a child. So my dad is a 100% medically retired veteran. He has PTSD. And so growing up, there was this phase where he wasn't at home. And then there was this new phase where he was finally at home, but he was having to get some help with his PTSD. And he was pretty isolated, pretty reclusive to usually be such a fun, loving, joking guy. So there was that season of my life that was definitely lonely, navigating that. And then when I got married, I originally married a guy who was a 9-to-5 sort of dude. He was a sales rep for the Atlanta Falcons football team. So we were living very comfortably, making very good money on a very dependable routine. And 6 months into marriage, he comes home and says he wants to be a pilot. And so that throws, you know, marriage for a loop, his career journey, our financial situation. And so next thing I know, he's finished flight school and he's at the nearest airport that's available at that time, because before COVID, pilots were in high demand, but pilots were meeting that demand. So you were going wherever there was space available. And that was Indiana. And at the time we lived in Georgia. So we are states away. I'm still dealing with some mental health stuff growing up in the home that I did. I had undiagnosed OCD at the time. And so loneliness is something that I initially thought marriage would fix. I think that's a concept most women think, maybe even, I don't know, you could speak to that as a guy, but even though you're married, that doesn't necessarily fix all aspects of loneliness. And so this big journey of loneliness that I've been on for almost 2 decades is what inspired the book.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that I want to hit on there. And so first, let me ask you about your experience with your dad. So he was a member of the military. And at what age did you kind of see that shift? Like how much of your time with him as a child were things, I guess, relatively normal? And then there was a bit of a change.
So he served for 24 years with the 82nd Airborne. So he jumped out of airplanes for a living. So his body was physically beat up for a long time. But I think when I was about 12 or 13 is when the PTSD really kicked in. So he had 3 separate counts of traumatic brain injury. So as I was a child growing up, it was nothing for us to realize that he had had traumatic brain injury. He was, you know, in the hospital just from his line of work. You're in the line of danger all the time. So I think each account of TBI kept adding up and kept adding up until the time I was about 12 or 13 is when you could see an emotional switch in him that something was definitely different. And because the PTSD had progressed so much, he was sent home for a while. So he was home for about a good 8 or 9 months. And for the first time in my life, I was around him on a consistent basis, but it wasn't in a very happy light. So it was a very strange dynamic to walk through, especially as a 13-year-old when life's already weird in general, yeah, like across the board. So that's what that was like growing up. It was just very strange navigating his mental health journey alongside him, because in the process, I would learn later on, I picked up secondary PTSD, which is very common if you grow up in that household. So lots of strange gray spaces to navigate as a kid.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, especially at such a kind of a integral part of your life as a teenager, where you said so many things are so strange. I mean, you know, even in a, what could be considered a stable environment, as there's changes happening with your body and your hormones and different things like that, you want certain things, you need certain things, but you don't even necessarily know what those things are.
Exactly.
And it's crazy. Sometimes, I mean, I remember being a teenager and just being like angry at my parents, and there was no reason why I should have been angry at them, or just all of a sudden then flipping a switch and like really needing them in certain moments. It's just, it's really crazy.
Absolutely. So you throw that exact dynamic in with a parent who isn't necessarily not there out of like sheer will or malice, but a parent who isn't there because they're not really there for themselves either. Like they're navigating their own hard stuff. And so it was just a strange dynamic.
Yeah. Now, at that age, were you also struggling? So you had said that there were some undiagnosed OCD tendencies. Again, if I'm not using any of the words right,
no,
please
good.
Correct me. So was that also happening at that same time, or is that something developed later?
Yeah. So OCD, as far as I know, so OCD, most people think means you just like a tidy space, like you have to have things in order. My car is probably hosting gremlins somewhere in it. Like I am not a neat freak when it comes to my personal space, but OCD in and of itself develops pretty much at birth. So it's something where your fight or flight, your adrenaline glands are not developed correctly. It's also where neuron transmitters don't fire correctly. So there's scientific stuff that typically happens at birth. But for most people, the difference between mild and moderate to moderate severe is if you experience childhood trauma. So they figured out childhood trauma can kind of catapult it and make it much worse into adulthood. So at the time, I didn't know it was OCD and already had some tendencies as a kid. But once everything with my dad happened, once I grew up learning to be tense, learning to stress, adopting anxiety is just the norm. Like just feeling on edge all the time was totally normal. That catapulted it. And the crazy thing is, again, it would take me another 10, 15 years to actually go get some help from a therapist.
Mm. Wow. Yeah. I have very little familiarity with OCD. And I was thinking, like you had said, exactly what most people probably were, which is, you know, a lot, you see it in the movies, a lot of washing right. the hands or how they might portray it in those instances. And then there was a point in your book where you were saying it might kind of rear its head in really strange instances of like, oh, I texted my mom at 7 this morning because I had a question. And now I'm wondering if I actually woke her up and is she going to be too tired to drive and leave? So just talk through like some of those things and how most people don't understand that.
Yeah. So OCD, if you break it down, so there is contamination OCD. That is a thing, which is the hand washing. So it's not like it's totally off. There's symmetrical OCD, which is where you want all the pencils lined up. You color coordinate your closet. But there's also what they call pure and intrusive thought OCD. And essentially what it is where you have a thought you don't want, which everyone does. Like when you get mad at someone, you're like, oh my gosh, I could just kill them. Like everyone has those crazy thoughts, but with OCD, what happens is your adrenaline glands attach to that thought and you can't let it go. So then it's, oh, this could be real. Oh, I could have actually meant this. What if I did mean this? What if I did kill that person and I don't know it? Like your brain just goes haywire and it obsesses over the thought to the point where you follow through with a compulsion. So I have done this before where I've been driving down the road and I think I've turned a corner too sharply or I went through a light when it was yellow and I'm like, what if I caused a wreck and have no clue? And the compulsion is I have turned my car around and visited that spot to make sure nothing actually happened to anyone. So where I think people get OCD confused is the compulsion. So the C in OCD, where the thought is so real and you can't shake it to your body physically follows through with a compulsion.
Okay. Let's try to talk about then, what it's like to exist around you as a person. So I can imagine that there are certain moments where if you're driving alone in your car and you're thinking, I may have ran that yellow light and caused some type of accident and you're turning around, that's an inconvenience to yourself that's caused by this mental disorder. But what if there's somebody in the car with you? Like, what did you need from people? Like what type of support were people able to provide? Or were there even examples of when things weren't handled correctly?
Growing up, my parents, obviously my mom was trying to deal so much with my dad while also kind of functioning as the mom and dad while he was so unwell with me, my sister, mine was not addressed at all. It was Peyton's just a worrier. Peyton just over worries. Peyton just stopped stressing. And one of the biggest things they say with OCD is you can't suppress it. So, and logic doesn't work. So you telling me, hey, that didn't actually happen. Just chill. There's no such thing as chill when your adrenaline glands are literally not balancing out. Like my body can't chill. So growing up, there was no help, which only made it worse. With therapy, they do what's called brain spotting, which is very, very healthy for me. So take a thought I don't want, take something I'm hyped about that my brain can't walk back. And my therapist starts asking me questions relevant to that. But then the questions get relevant to me. It's more of a heart and soul thing. I start working through, okay, so I think I might've ran someone off the road and I'm terrified that might've happened, but the initial worry, the initial anxiety that already had me so willing to follow through with an OCD trigger always comes back to something from childhood. So brain spotting is taking the current worry and tracking it to where it initially came from. And most of the time with OCD, you have a trigger that's silly, like feeling like you've got to wash your hands 50 times or turning around your car, but your inherent fear is that you're a bad person. Not that an accident happened, but you might have caused something deliberately. So walking it back to, hey, no, actually, this is what you experienced in childhood. This is how you see the world. You tend to operate out of anxiety, which is not normal or healthy. You're almost reaffirming your identity is pretty much what OCD is, you know, trying to heal the original identity.
Hmm. When did you start having therapy then, or participating in it?
Yeah, so I didn't get therapy until Josh was gone on his first big piloting gig, because I was a new wife. I had a new job. I had lots of things to kind of distract myself and keep myself busy, lots of new. But when he left, I was sitting by myself a lot. There was a lot of quiet time. And I've learned when you're alone, your brain tends to pull all the monsters out of your closet, all the dusty things out from under your bed that you've just kind of shoved away. And I wasn't handling things well at all. So probably about a month into him being gone, I decided to start counseling. And at the time I was 25. So between about 13, when everything with my dad was pretty bad, it was a good 12-year gap before I actually got help for myself. Hmm.
And what is that process like? I'm sure it's different based on, you know, where you're getting therapy and who your therapist is, but could you kind of take us through what that process is in terms of trying to retrace the root of some of these issues?
Yeah. So it starts very strange. It has a weird vibe. So with, at least with brain spotting is a method that really works well for me. You find a light space in the room. So it's called finding your gaze spot. So your eyes tend to look away or gaze at natural comfort, and you don't realize that you're always trying to find comfort. And so for me, it was always natural light. If there was a window, there was a big window in my therapist's room. So I always would look at the light. And so you stare at that. You don't look at your therapist. You don't twiddle your thumbs. You don't look at anything that could distract you. You just look at the one spot that kind of calms you down. And the therapist, I don't understand all the mechanics or the magic, but they start asking very relevant questions about the thought you can't shake. And then it does turn into kind of that movie feel of, well, how does that make you feel? Where do you think that's coming from? And it's just you rambling for like 50 minutes. But what you don't realize is your ramblings are literally coming right back to the root of whatever the problem is. And you don't realize it, but an hour later, a lot of the times I went, oh, that's from just always feeling like I was living stress. Like I was always feeling on edge. I was always anxious, and I've still got to work to grow through that. And so brain spotting works for me. EMDR therapy, which is another form of exposure therapy, is very similar to that. I am very pro medication. If that's what you need, I think medicine is a modern miracle. I am not a hater on medicine whatsoever. So I have taken anxiety medicine. We've upped the dosages before. We've pulled them back when I'm doing well. And so I'm a big proponent of in-person therapy because there's lots of natural ways to combat it. But also I do the medication, and I don't think there's any shame in that.
Yeah. Okay. So you were kind of doing the, you know, the all-encompassing approach. Yes. Like let's cover as many bases. I think there's exactly a word for that. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, very interesting. So you had also kind of outlined in your book, growing up, and it seemed like as you got a little bit older, was there, you can explain this better, but was there like a search for companionship, and specifically male companionship, and trying to find some worth in that?
Sure. So, you know, my dad was gone all the time. So not that there wasn't a male figure at home, but there wasn't. 99% of the time it was my mom and it was my little sister. So no brothers. I wasn't very close to my dad's side of the family, so no paternal role over there. But I also grew up in a church culture that put a lot of women's self-worth and marriage, like that was the end goal. And so for me, when that didn't happen as quickly as most of my friends, I'm from the deep South where most women do honestly get married at 21 and have kids by 22. So for me at 19, 20, I am not married. I'm not just not married. I'm not seriously dating anyone. It gave me a complete identity crisis because I assumed my singlehood was a direct reflection of shame that maybe I should be embodying, that something was wrong with me, because even the religious leaders who were supposed to be guiding me were also telling me, hey, you haven't met the mark yet. So yeah, I experienced a lot of that in teenagehood.
Yeah. That's something that I really hope as a broader church culture we're working through is there are some things that, you know, are still pretty pervasive, where it seems like we're bringing women up to fulfill a role, which is as a wife, that is then supposed to be geared towards completing this man and being, you know, a helper. And there are aspects of that I think can still ring true. But yeah, that's just, to me, is a pretty harmful ideology. And I wonder how many people are feeling a lack of self-worth because they haven't been, you know, taught in the way and stewarded in the way that maybe they should be.
Right. I get young women all the time who say that exact same thing come to me and think the worst part is they think it's a them problem. Like it's mm-hmm. not just a season they're in. It's not just, hey, not your time yet. They truly think there is some inherent problem with them. And it's very hard to speak truth into that and have them accept it when for years they've been told something completely different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny. If you spend time in the church culture, like I kind of have these running jokes that I'll make where, you know, we stereotype, maybe the kids in high school that are, drinking and doing drugs, and they're going to be the ones that are pregnant by 18 and married after dating someone for 6 months. And I kind of think to myself, like, no, actually, I think it tends to be the Christians where they meet someone and then boom, they're married within 6 months. And I get that sometimes that can be a thing that works. But that is almost like a stereotype that I think exists within the church too.
It's self-worth for women is found when they're married. Like that is the be all end all goal. And so I get married. I finally check the box. Like I'm the last in the race, but I check the box. And then this season of loneliness comes for me. And I was told when I got married, everything would be fine. Like that mm-hmm. was truly the end goal as a woman, but it was not working. Like I was married and I was going through this hard season and I'm sitting here thinking, but I thought I did everything right. So what now?
Mm-hmm. So when someone would maybe tell you, hey, Peyton, your senses of loneliness that you're experiencing, those are going to subside when you find a marriage and you're in a long-term relationship like that. Do you think they're telling you that loneliness will subside because you finally have this partner that's going to be in the vicinity, or the loneliness will subside because you're going to be so busy trying to accompany that person on what they should be doing?
I think it could be both. So I think there's just this natural pull of, hey, it's not just you in the picture anymore, but there's also this push that you are helpmate, you are helpmate, you are helpmate. You're taking care of the house. You're there to balance the kids. You're there to make sure everything's ready while he goes off to work. I think it was both. And mm-hmm. I think sometimes if you grew up like I did in a very legalistic culture, there's almost this sense that you haven't arrived spiritually until you're married. So, oh, you're lonely because you're just not there yet. Mm-hmm. So there's also this sense of the loneliness is coming from something that you lack.
Yeah.
And it really, the perception is just totally off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think you're right. It probably is a combination in some ways. It probably depends who you're hearing it from.
Right.
Too. So I think you had mentioned maybe both of these words or maybe I had created this question myself, but solitude versus loneliness. Is that something that you've explored or thought about at all? Like individuals, you know, they can seek solitude because they mm-hmm. need time for themselves or to work things out. Loneliness isn't something we necessarily seek, but both of them, I think, are being alone with yourself.
Right. I think when it's handled, I wouldn't say correctly, because I think often healing is incredibly messy. I don't think anyone just heals overnight, but often if you're willing to face real solitude, loneliness doesn't hold as much weight. So I think one is almost the gateway to healing from the other. So when you're willing to sit by yourself and actually let the monsters come out of the closet and face them, for me with therapy I wasn't physically by myself. There was somewhere there, but that was almost solitude. That was, hey, let's sit with your thoughts. Let's sit with the pieces of you that for years have not been okay. I think when you're willing to face solitude from the place of, hey, let's cast some light on some things we haven't been willing to work through and let's work through them, it combats loneliness. So I guess in theory, you can see loneliness and solitude in the same light, but I think one's the gateway to being free from the other.
Okay. So solitude is kind of a bit of an exercise in combating loneliness or figuring out maybe how to handle it.
Exactly.
Because we will experience loneliness at some point.
Right.
You know, all of us do. And it doesn't, I don't think, mean that we have to be comfortable in that loneliness, but there is something to be said about being able to cope with it, I would think.
Absolutely. That's the tagline of my book. So it's a safe space where God doesn't fix the loneliness, but sits with you instead.
Yeah.
It's this idea that sometimes loneliness, you're not meant to just have your fingers snapped and then poof, you're not lonely anymore. There's a beauty to the process of discovering that you aren't alone. But sometimes that very thing takes the solitude to realize such a truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That tagline reminds me of the word lament, which is a word that's really come to the forefront for me through a couple of people that have kind of brought it up to me, especially with as things happen in our culture and our society, mm-hmm. that there are just, we're called for moments of lament to just sit right. with people and not just try to fix things. And all right, to me, nobody does that better than God. Like he's right. going to sit with you in those difficulties. And so I really do like that. It reminded me of lament quite a bit.
I love that. That's awesome.
Yeah. So was there a point, now we've covered kind of the buildup to, I guess, these major bouts of loneliness and I would think sadness. Was there a point where you were able to realize like, okay, there's been this buildup and now this is the inflection point, or this is the turning point where something's either going to get much, much worse, or we're going to actually be able to do something about it?
So I will be totally frank with you. And this could make some people just lament in and of themselves, mm-hmm. but I finally had this very authentic, raw prayer where I verbatim just looked up at the sky and I said, God, what in the hell are you doing? Mm-hmm. What are you doing? Because I'm going to choose to believe you're doing something, but I just think you should know I'm not okay with it. Yeah. And I'm just going to be honest because I have nothing left to give. I've hit a brick wall emotionally, physically, spiritually. I mean, I was over here losing 2-3 pounds a week. I wasn't eating. Mm. I wasn't getting out of my house. You know, I'd come straight home from work and lock myself up. I had nothing left to give him, but I was trying to choose to believe he was giving me something in this season. And in the middle of that messiness, I still wasn't okay. And I still wanted him to know that. So the pinnacle for me was I honestly ended up in our hallway floor, just crying and just being willing to say, I don't know how holy or unholy it is, but I just said, what the hell are you doing? Cause I am not a fan of this. And that's literally the only prayer I could offer him. There was mm-hmm. nothing after that. But I will tell you, while I don't promote cussing in prayers whatsoever, that was the freest prayer. That was a breaking point for me because for once I didn't have to be anxious. I could just be honest, and I didn't have to be perfect. I could show up flawed. And so that mm-hmm. was a very, very pivotal point for me in that season.
Yeah. I love that. And we had talked about, or I guess why I was interested in talking with you is that I knew that this conversation could be framed in a way that's beneficial for those that aren't Christian, right. And also for those that are. And I think there's some additional pieces of the puzzle that, in my opinion, they fit much better when you allow God to work in certain right. ways. But I understand there's people out there that are just not there yet. But some things that I've realized this last year, which you bring to my mind, is that he can work so much more effectively with a hopeless person, because someone that is hopeless, they have finally had the realization of like, I can't do this on my own. And to me, yep. that's what that feels like when you say that you said that prayer.
Absolutely. There was finally hope in the midst of complete failure. Like I had been carrying lots of weight, even from everything that happened in my childhood. And I had finally just dropped every bit of it and I couldn't clean it up. There was way too mm-hmm. much of a mess for me to clean up by myself.
Yeah. And then the other thing I was thinking, as you said, I just asked him what the hell he was doing, is we sometimes in our prayers can be most effective when we can gain a level of intimacy with God when we're casual with our language. And that is something I think I've kind of probably not known at the level I should. We grow up hearing these super formal prayers and we're just blown away by people that can use the vocabulary that they uh-huh. do and spout these prayers off. And we think, man, that person really knows how to connect with God. And you find out and you think about your own life and people that you interact with is who are the people you are closest with? It's typically the people that you can talk the most casually with. And so yeah. intimacy and casual can go hand in hand. And so when we have casual conversations with God, I think in a lot of ways, that's actually a way to have a more intimate connection.
Yeah. And I don't think, I mean, obviously there was no writing on the wall, even though that would have been very nice. After I said that, I just kind of sat there because, you know, I'm processing, you just cussed in a prayer. Like, what do you do now? Like, mm-hmm. do we go around and ask forgiveness for a prayer? And I definitely didn't hear him audibly, but it's almost like I just had this sense of God saying, hey, now we're talking. Like literally mm-hmm. now we're talking. This is me and you. This is how you should show up every day, not necessarily cussing, but you showing up willing to be so flawed and so honest. That's when I think humans are most malleable. That's when we can bend and twist and morph and we can let him paint a much better picture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's I think so, so true. It sounds to me like you've learned a ton and you've become wise in your experiences. And what's interesting about processes like this, processes as you try to work through mental health issues or become a better person or to sharpen your faith, is that it's a never ending thing. So while we gather these tools, it doesn't mean that we're going to always implement them properly. And so is that something that you've also realized too, is like, yes, I'm in a better position than I was, but I still, there's things I'm screwing up that I still just should not be, but somehow I am.
Oh, absolutely. So day one of therapy, when day one of therapy is always like, hey, tell me your life story. You just have to spill everything so your therapist can process things. She looked at me and she said, yeah, you got OCD, like 100%. That is what we have. She said, but I also want you to know, I am sorry that there's no cure. There's no, for people with bipolar or schizophrenia disorders, there truly is a pill where it can rebalance the chemicals and can totally help you, like do a 180. Mm-hmm. With OCD, there's no such thing. Medication does help, but there's no fix for this. And so OCD is probably my biggest battle still. It's a place where I tend to dip back into that, hey, I'm a failure. Hey, I can't handle this. I don't even have a grip on my own brain, nonetheless, my whole life. But I guess what I'm trying to do is number one, accept that this will be a part of me. Unless there's a miracle in science where we do find a pill, this will be me for the rest of my life. And I'm choosing to see this as my thorn in the side, because I think there are thorns in the side, like with Paul. I think they keep you humble. I think they remind you who you are and who God is. But I also think if you're willing to face your thorn in the side and accept that it is what it is, I think there's a chance that a thorn can still bloom. And so that's what I'm doing. I'm stepping back and saying, this is a thorn, does not feel good, but there's got to be a reason it's here, and I'm going to bloom and grow through it regardless. And so that's where vulnerability and being super honest. I mean, in my book about OCDs come from, it's choosing to believe that, hey, if someone had said the things I'm saying in this book and I picked up this book 10 years ago, it would have saved me so much hurt. And so if I can step in and say, hey, you're okay, it's OCD, and hey, God is so much better than you're painting him out to be. If I can do that for someone else, then I'll carry this thorn in my side with a different perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like that. And I'm also thinking about, was it Jacob that wrestled and he had a wounded hip and walked with a limp? And a huge part of my listening base is non-Christian. But I want to encourage them, like, if you're reading Gandhi and other philosophy books or whatever, like, pick up the Bible too, because there are just some really cool stories in there. And I mean, that's what Jacob did, is he was wrestling. He was wrestling with uncertainty and things that he was not happy about. And then there were these lessons learned. And oftentimes they were left with just these reminders that that accompany us into the next thing that we have to face.
And I'm so glad you brought up Jacob. So I'm doing like a deep dive into the Old Testament. I'm in Leviticus right now, which is brutal. Like it's just not fun, but I read Jacob's account recently and I love the verse when he's wrestling with God and he literally says, I won't let go until you bless me. So what I love is Jacob's willing to stay in the fight because he believes there's something better that will come out of it. So I love that wrestling and purification and hope can coexist all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's countless examples, you know, David as well, where he's, you know, cursing God in one sentence and the next sentence, he's like, oh, you know, putting it into crazy special words, where he's just like, I can't believe how amazing you are. And that's, I don't know that there's a more accurate representation. Those were real people that were struggling with things, just like we struggle with things, where one second you're complaining, life is not fair, it couldn't possibly get any worse. And then the next second, you probably just feel this incredible sense of overwhelm and experiencing grace that you never imagined.
Exactly. No, that's it verbatim.
Yeah. So where are you at right now with everything? Like, have you seen, how long has your book been out, I guess is the question.
It came out at the very end of November. So I started writing it like 2 months before the pandemic. And so what happened is my publisher said, hey, I know you're only 5,000 words in, but can you get me 60,000 words in a month? Like the whole world is facing loneliness. So not like, it was kind of a bittersweet thing that, hey, this is a really great marketing pitch, but also really sad because loneliness is now unavoidable, like regardless of who you are or where you live. So I wrote it during the pandemic. It came out at the end of November. So it's been out almost a year. We're working on a year now.
Okay. Yeah. Cause when we had talked at the beginning, you were saying it was just kind of really strange timing. I was working on this project and then boom, pandemic happens where people are all of a sudden faced with solitude or loneliness, whether they want to or not.
Yep.
And that's just very, very interesting timing. And I've seen that play out quite a bit over the course of the pandemic, where we are, whatever your views are on shutdowns and quarantining and whatever, we all should be seeing that there are things that people are struggling with all the time, even right. outside of a pandemic, that will then come to the forefront during a pandemic. And maybe instead of us just saying, oh, well, that's because a pandemic was going on, like that'll get better once it's over. Mm-hmm. We should be saying, well, wait, if they were struggling with that beforehand, like what can we do to make sure that it's not happening in the future? So I'm curious, exactly. like how much of that, you know, played into your book too.
Oh yeah. Because it goes back to that whole idea of, okay, monsters, you can come out of the closet because I'm going to be here all day by myself. Mm-hmm. Like there's no one to keep you pinned up in there. There's nothing to keep all the dust swept under the rug. Like we're here. And you know, it's after you've worked on your computer, you've let out the dogs, you've drank your third cup of coffee and you can't go anywhere. There's like by 12 o'clock every day, I was just sitting like just mm-hmm. with nothing to do, but process anything and everything that my brain had prepared for me. So I totally agree. I think the pandemic just, it, I think it caused people in this culture and in 2019, 2020 ish to finally slow down. I think we're really good at distracting ourselves and staying busy and playing on the phone and doing all the things, going to all the places. So we don't have to process anything. And I think this was just a big way of saying, hey world, take a break, you know, take a breather, slow down, and let's actually look at some things that you haven't really wanted to face in a while.
Mm-hmm. I was explaining this to someone maybe a week or so ago, where I had said, what was so fascinating about the pandemic is that obviously there are people that were deeply impacted by it, whether they mm-hmm. lost loved ones or whether they lost a job or were affected financially. But even those who kept their job, kept their health, all those things, and otherwise are coming out of this thing unscathed, they were still impacted because mm-hmm. everyone in their environment was impacted. You still couldn't go out and do things in the way that you normally would. And so we think about the richest, the wealthiest, the most famous people that typically have the most freedom, even mm-hmm. they were impacted. And just how we were all, despite our circumstances, presented with opportunities to either evaluate our lives and say, this needs to change. And the pandemic made me realize, you know, that I have to fix whatever this is in my life, or man, I think we got to really start to care about other people because they are right. being really impacted by something beyond their control.
Absolutely. Totally agree.
So can you just, you had some really entertaining stories in your book that you were able to just bring back and relate to some of your struggles and your experiences. Could you just outline a couple without spoiling it for people? Like I had written down The House on the Corner. And how yeah. I just thought that was a major symbol. And I think you thought that same thing too. So just, could you go through that one for us?
Yeah. So I think it's like chapter three. It's pretty early on. When my husband and I first got married, we bought this little fixer upper that was on a corner lot on a main highway. And we had some pretty ratchet neighbors across the highway, like mm-hmm. torn rebel battle flags, like laced every window. The porch was falling in. Like, we could hear lots of swanky music, lots of cops all the time. Like it was yeah. just bad. It was like the other side of the tracks, but the other side of the highway. And I am outside one night. It's the first time Josh and I have actually not been together like overnight since he was married. We were married. He was away doing something. And I'm outside letting out the dogs. And there is this lady just standing in my driveway. And it is the lady who lives across the road. And she is drunk. She's drunk. I think she was a little high as well. Apparently she'd just gotten out of jail. She just found out the man across the road was running around on her. And I'm just standing there like, I'll just be honest. I was like, do I go and get my gun and just have it on my belt just in case? Mm-hmm. Like, do I call 911? Do I stand here? And I, you know, it was totally God, because Peyton did not want to do this, but he was like, just let her sit, just invite her to sit down. And so I said the very thing that I wish people would say to me when they know something's wrong. I just said, hey, are you okay? Like, hey, what, you know, what's wrong? So I pull out a folding chair, let her, you know, drink her liquor from a coffee mug. And she just starts telling me all her things. She's rambling. A lot of things don't make sense. She ends up telling me she wants to see the inside of my house. So like a dummy, I let a stranger in my house. She locks herself in my bathroom at one point. I'm pretty sure she was probably trying to scrounge for like prescription medicine or something. left my house, like, and she was gone. And I still don't fully know what to make of that. I asked for her name just so I could remember her, think about her, pray for her. But I think the underlying lesson was, I think if you live on the corner, and what I mean by the corner is live on the edge, if you're willing to just say, hey, are you okay? You'll just let people talk, even the kind of scary people. I think there's this community you build and you don't even realize. And it's not just the community between you and that person. I think there's a community between you and God where you've opened up your door for him to kind of let you extend grace to others a little more. And what happens is, what I love, I think one of the things I love the most is when you start learning to give others grace, you start giving yourself grace. And for someone like me who lives so rigidly, was so tense, strive for perfection, that's where all my freedom comes from, is, you know, channeling and harnessing that grace that God's given me to give to other people. It comes back. And I think that's what I learned the most from letting a stranger just meander through my house.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing how, you know, you were someone that was struggling with loneliness. You were alone. Your husband was gone. Yeah. And it was something you were facing. And then boom, there's a friend for you to spend a little bit of time with.
Yeah. And I remember her
crazy
name.
Crazy example.
Yeah. It's been three years. I remember her name to this day. I remember her. I mean, all the things, like, I'd only seen this woman once or twice in my life, but I could remember that day like it was yesterday. Mm-hmm. And I think that's for a reason.
Yeah. I think there's something about, you know, it would be easy to say being a Christian, and that would be assuming that all Christians would have approached that situation in the same way, but we know that that's not true. But there is something about being a person that is on the lookout and is open to experiences like that, because you had many options. You could have called the police. You could have yelled at her to get away. Right. You could have been unwelcoming. And it's amazing the stuff that we can learn when we are open to experiences like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I was just thinking of some of the things. I have stories similar to that, and I learned a lot in the instances where I was open to those things. And then I also think I learned a lot in the instances where I failed whatever test was being put in front of me. And so before the pandemic, it was probably shortly before everything got shut down. I had seen a lady in town. She was very rough looking. I think her story was also that she just got out of rehab or just got out of jail. I stopped and picked her up because she was, I don't even know that she was technically hitchhiking, but she was carrying a lot of heavy stuff. Like, you could tell she had just gotten dumped, on the side of the street and had too much to carry, and she was going somewhere. And so I just asked her if she needed a ride, and we had a conversation, and I gave her $20, and I think I did some good with that, like to get her across town to where she needed to be so she could find a little bit of stability. And then I was presented with this other opportunity, and this is one that I regret, but we were at the grocery store. My wife and I were checking out, and it was a pretty busy line behind us. And people, for some reason, I don't know what it is, but they get so impatient in grocery lines. And I'm yes, one of those people too. It's like, I can have nowhere to be, but I just can't stand to be in the grocery line. I don't get what it is, but there was a busy line, and this lady comes in from outside and is trying to talk to our cashier while he's trying to check people out and keep us moving along. And she's just like yelling about where the orange juice is. And she's asking her question in such a way that the cashier's like almost incapable of actually helping, because I think he's kind of offended by the way she's asking. And I was a social worker before I was in what I'm doing now, okay, which is podcast production. And so I've very familiar with people like that and interacting with them. And I just failed the test. As soon as I left the grocery store after having ignored her and kind of just like, said, we're trying to get through the line here. Can you get out of our way? I was like, dude, why didn't you just like save her from embarrassment and say, oh, you know what? I forgot orange juice. I want to go with you to get some orange juice because I actually was planning to get some and I forgot. So thanks for reminding me. And I could have just taken a walk with her and shown her the orange juice aisle. I know right where it was in the back left corner. And that has like stuck with me in a very profound way of, when is the next time that I can just save someone embarrassment and help them? And maybe I missed out on an opportunity for a few minute conversation as we were walking to the orange juice as well, just seeing, hey, what is the deal? Why are you yelling about this? What else is going on, I guess.
Right.
And so I think I learned as much from that failure as I did from the times when I've quote unquote done some good. And that's really stuck with me, is just being open to things like that, because you can do good, but you're almost always stretched in a way that benefits you more than I think the person you actually help.
Absolutely. I totally agree.
Yeah. So are there any other, I guess, like I said, I'm only halfway through your book. I don't yet know how it ends, but, are there any other lessons, as we're at about the 45 minute mark, any other lessons you want to impart on people, or part of your story that you think people would benefit from?
You know, I have biases. Like, I have some chapters that I'm just a fan of, but mine tend not to be the readers, which I just find so funny. But one response I keep getting is way later in the game. Like, I think one of the last two chapters, I talk about the difference between staying and remaining with people. And so the word stay, you know, we think you stay with someone. And when you break down the Hebrew meaning of stay, it has like 9 different meanings. But one of the Hebrew meanings of stay is to remain. And so it's this idea that so often in our culture, when things are unhealthy, whether it's an unhealthy relationship, an unhealthy work environment, an unhealthy church environment, like what I experienced, we stay, we hang on because it's comfort. It's what we know. It means we don't have to start all over, but we're not remaining. So staying tends to work out of routine, while remaining tends to work out of redemption. And remaining is when you stay with a church, you stay with a person because you believe in that season they're in, and you're willing to abide through that season, even if it's loneliness. And so that's something that a lot of my readers have really enjoyed, this concept that God doesn't just stay because he has to with you. You don't have to just stay in a relationship because it's what you do. When you're willing to step back and look at God in a light of grace and mercy, you realize he's remaining and that you're called to remain with people. And rather than just sticking with something to stick with it, you abide through a season, even if it's rough. And so much later on, but that's a concept that most of my readers tend to really enjoy.
Oh, that's really awesome way to kind of end our discussion here, because yeah, you're exactly right. I don't know that similar to solitude and loneliness, we can kind of treat those words as the same thing, but they're not. And staying and remaining, that's really interesting. You talk about Hebrew, and it'd be so cool if we all knew Hebrew and Greek, because I think, right? It just goes so much deeper than English. Like, you know, absolutely, there's just so much more to it. That'd be really awesome. But thank you so much. Where can people find your book and find out more about you?
Yeah. So Not So By Myself is on Amazon. That's going to be your quickest way to find it. I also have a website, peytongarland.me. You can order it there. You can check out more. I have some Not So By Myself merch there. And then if you want to connect on social media, at Peyton M. Garland author is where you can find me online as well.
Sweet. And be honest, will you get a bigger cut of the sales if they order it from your website rather than Amazon?
I get, it's kind of a toss up. So I get more money from Amazon, I get more money through me, but Amazon boosts my rankings, which boosts my marketing, which can also get me more sales. So it's kind of like a catch 22. So if you will buy it on Amazon, my only request is that you leave a review. So that's the thing. Get on Amazon, try to leave a review, but also come through my website. If you want to get it there, there's also a page or a tab on my website where you can connect with me one-on-one. If you ever want to just talk about the book, just us two when you're finished. So I'm happy to have that conversation with readers as well.
Awesome. Yeah. That's very good to know, as someone who greatly depends on reviews myself. Yeah. I understand the importance of it. So I'm going to make sure to go do that today too.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Peyton, thank you so much for joining us today. And, I would encourage listeners to go purchase that book if loneliness is something that you're struggling with. But even if you're not, I think you would learn a lot and figure out how to best support the people that are in your life. So don't actually leave, but I'm going to bid our listeners farewell.
All right. Sounds great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And thank you guys for listening. We love you. Bye-bye.